You're listening to Run Hard, Mom Hard, presented by Treeline Journal and hosted by Nikki Parnell
and Steph Weniger. We're here looking at the ins and outs of what it takes to be a mother who runs ultra marathons.
We'll dive into the challenges mothers face while training and racing ultras as we share and hear stories of motherhood and life from the trails.
We hope to be a resource and encouragement to women who are balancing life with kids and all the miles. It's no easy task. We know what goes on behind the scenes while a mom prepares for a long run or race day. Sick kids, lack of sleep, low energy, minimal time, mom guilt, etc.
But women keep showing up again and again to run, take care of themselves, and show this sport new levels of strength and grit. We want to be here to celebrate and inspire each other to run hard, find our inner mom strength, and show our kids that so much is possible. Welcome to another episode of Run Hard, Mom Hard. Steph, what is up in your life?
Yeah, we just got back from a week-long vacation. We did my 50K recap. I forgot to mention that we did see a bear as we were driving out of the state park, and so I was super happy. We were both looked at each other. We're like, thank goodness we did not see that while we were running. And then, so we just spent so much time. I mean, from the moment we woke up until the moment we went to bed, we were outside. We had a bonfire going the whole time because it was cool up there. Even now it's like 40 degrees outside, for a high. But we went up to the North Shore and we went hiking and we found this like hidden lake and it was just so pretty. And you could see the big hill, rolling hills in the background. And, we went.
Sorry, was that on the Superior Hiking Trail?
Yes. Yep. Okay. It was on the SHD. Yep. Yeah. And it was a little like nature center, in Duluth. It just felt so secluded. You couldn't see anything. And it was just, I mean, it was only a mile away from the nature center that we walked to. But it was just so, so gorgeous. And on Saturday, so the day before we left, we went, kayaking down the river, which is, it's a really shallow river. It doesn't move very fast. We normally go like tubing on it on inner tubes. And we just float. And so I'm like, we'll just go during nap time because last time we floated, Amelia just fell asleep on me. So she'll just fall asleep kayaking on me. Well, we got to this point in the river and it was like a 2.5 hour trip. We got to a point and Aaron's like, oh, there's a fallen tree over here, but there was another way to like get around. And it was this huge open lake and we went to cross it thinking that the river continued on. And there was a guy saying, oh, you're going to have to turn around. There's no exit here. But there is a huge tree that fell. So you got to be careful of that. So we're like, oh, well, that must be the tree that Aaron saw. Well, it wasn't. And it was like 20 minutes further down the river. And there was this massive pine tree that had fallen. And so there was only like a couple feet on one side of the river that you could get through. And Amelia ended up falling asleep on me. So I was tied onto Aaron's kayak. And I tried like protecting Amelia, because she was just sleeping on my chest, from the pine tree, and I flipped.
No, you did not.
Yes, I did.
Completely
flipped over.
Oh my gosh.
I slammed my knee and my shin into this big rock, and I tripped, and I was holding her, and she's like trying to breathe because she got dunked underwater. Oh. And I stood up, and I tripped, and then Aaron had to stop the kayak quick, and Joanna was like kind of falling asleep in his kayak. And so he was trying not to get dunked too. And, I lost my hat. I lost my Gooder glasses. Like we lost shoes. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is just insane. And Amelia was crying and none of us had, no, I know she was not happy at all. But she actually calmed down before she fell asleep. She was just crying super loud because I think she was overtired. But she was actually calmer after she got dunked, woken up, you know, in cold water. But none of us had our phones. And I thought, I'm like, I swore when I stood up, I said, my knee is broken. Like I felt like I couldn't put any pressure on it. I was just like trying so hard to stand there so that Amelia wouldn't go back in the water.
Oh.
And Before we started recording this, I was telling Nikki, about not having your phone on you when you run, and none of us had our phones. And we're in like the middle of nowhere in Wisconsin. Like, I don't know how we would have, if something would have happened that was so bad.
Right. Where you couldn't get out.
Yeah.
And so what did you do? Did you just get back?
Aaron dumped all the water out, cause it was just completely full, and he held the kayak so I could get back in, cause it was through that narrow pass. It was like pushing really hard.
Yeah.
Which normally the river is pretty calm. But then, so he just kept me attached to him on the kayak, but further down the river, it gets really rocky. And so I had kind of been going like sideways on the kayak, and we didn't want me to hit a rock and then flip over again onto the rock. So I like detached from Aaron, and that was a whole ordeal. And Joanna was sleeping, and he like lifted her up, and she just slunched over because she was just so dead asleep. And I was like trying to hold like one arm still because Amelia had fallen asleep again, and like paddle to get, you know, keep straight from the rocks. But we ended up making it down and it was fine. But
did your knee blow up? Like, did it swell?
No, it didn't blow up. I don't know if the cold water helped at all, but it's, I couldn't bend it. Like, I could bend it, but not like extreme bending. And then when I kneel, it's really, really painful. So when I'm trying to give the girls a bath, like I have to have my legs straight out. So I'll probably go to the doctor, in a couple days if it hasn't healed, cause then it'll be a week. My shin kind of exploded, but it's okay.
I'm glad you
let Amelia drop once.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Yeah. That is, that's exciting.
So anyway. That was a long story. Sorry.
That's adventure on the river.
Yeah. I know. My mom was like, I can't believe you took them on the river. And I'm like, well, they loved it until, you know, we fell in and, but.
Oh man. So funny.
So what's up with you after my long story?
Yeah. Well, I'm on about day 5 of being without a car.
Oh.
We are stuck, stranded, at our cabin. No, it's not that intense. It's okay. We have food, and actually, luckily, I got diapers like the day our car broke down.
Oh, good.
But yeah, we were having some car trouble, and it was just a bummer. And they couldn't really do anything about it in McCall, and so we had to get it towed by AAA Boise, which is 2 hours away. Yeah, so it's still in Boise, and they're working on it today. And I'm just hoping that we get it back, because it's just kind of funny when we're here in this cabin and we have to like take out our trash and our recycling, to like a service station, and which is like a mile away. And so just things are starting to pile up, you know, because we haven't gone out in the car to like take things. And Chase walked a trash bag down to the service station yesterday, but it's just, you know, it's just interesting. And really it's like a lot of the West is on fire. I mean, it seems clear where we are. There have been fires recently, like semi nearby, but nothing too crazy. It seems fine, but Oregon is really not doing well. California. I know a lot of people that are evacuated from their houses. And so I am just like, I just want to have a car in case we need a car, you know?
Yeah. You got to leave.
Yeah.
Cause my grandpa does some work in Colorado. He helps some guy. Honestly, I don't even remember what exactly he does, but he was saying that he couldn't see the tops of the mountains because the smoke was so bad. And he said, I didn't even think smoke traveled that far. It's so much. There's so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. When I was pregnant with Bellin, it was summer. It was like August. And honestly, that was the start of my bad relationship with the month of August. don't tend to love it because of the smoke. It's like you could barely see 15 feet in front of your face.
That's
and
insane.
It was just so, it gets so bad.
The only experience I have with that was, I don't remember if it was 2 years ago. There were fires in Canada north of us and it was coming down and it was like red.
Yes.
It was weird. That's the only experience I have. And it was maybe a couple of weeks of that, but it wasn't a ton.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the only experience I have.
Yeah. The Bridgers were in Bozeman where we used to live. They're on fire right now. There's like a huge, terrible fire up there. And it's just so sad because it's all the places that we love to run. I mean, these are like forests, you know, and, I don't know. It's sad, but
2020 is an insane year.
Exactly. I'm like, can there be more that we can really like worry about?
I saw this meme or whatever, and it was like the aliens getting ready. They're like, oh, we're up next month to come down. And I know that's not funny, but like, that's how it feels.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels like, what is going to come next?
I don't know. I know. So on that happy note, just kidding, we have an awesome mom out of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Her name is Jonna Perkins. She's a trail runner for La Sportiva. She's a farmer, food activist, writer. She does all the things.
All of the above, yeah.
Yes. And so we get to hear all about how she does all those things. And what her life looks like on her farm in Wisconsin, growing potatoes and living seasonally and
making sure she is buying all of her stuff or using stuff that's in her, I think she said micro region. And it's really interesting. And I think it's a really, really good episode, to be more aware of how you're eating.
Mm-hmm. And where your food comes from.
Yes.
And exactly. And little things that you can do to be more part of the solution of eating locally and helping small farmers and things like that. She has a very empowering message around food as well. And she does a lot of work with how food plays into adventure.
Yeah. Too.
And so she talks about some of her projects coming up with that.
And we'll link to everything in the show notes.
Yes.
That we can.
Well, yes. And there's a lot to link to. So
yes.
Check those out. Okay. So before we get to Jonna, we have some exciting news.
Mm-hmm.
We have our first sponsor for this Run Hard, Mom Hard podcast.
Yeah, we are working with Exoskin and we're so excited to be working with them. Exoskin is a running apparel company that makes seamless running gear with rapid dry copper technology.
Yes, and that protects runners from chafing, blisters, hot spots, odor. They're all 100% made in the U.S.,
yeah.
And there's been some incredible athletes that have been using this gear for long endurance endeavors, such as Alyssa Clark, who just recently, she broke the world record for the most consecutive marathons. So she ran 95 marathons in 95 days, which is pretty mind-blowing. And she wore the toe socks and the leg sleeves throughout that whole experience.
Yeah, she does talk a lot about it on Trail Runner Nation, her 95 marathon experiences. But I also wore the shorts that they sent us and the toe socks. So that was the 4.0 mid-compression bottoms, mid-rise. So it came up a little bit, which I really enjoyed that it was higher up. I'm not a huge, like, low-rise person. But I wore them for my 50K, and like if you heard in the podcast before, I was basically in water shoes for the first 12 miles.
Yes.
And I got tiny little blisters that went away the next day. So I thought those socks were amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And the shorts felt like it like held everything in, like I was compressed.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's what their goal is, but it felt so good.
Yes, there is compression there. There's some moisture wicking. Nothing rides up, you know, nothing moves.
Oh, yeah. Support,
but you're also like very flexible. Like they allow still for a lot of movement. You don't feel like you're
restricted. That.
Yes, restricted.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I've been really enjoying the shorts and the socks.
Yes. So we do have an exclusive discount code for our listeners, and you can use the code TREELINE for 20% off your purchase.
Yes, that is TREELINE, which we'll also have that in the show notes. And yeah, and really, you can head over to exoskin.us, shop around, use your discount code. By supporting Exoskin, which is a brand that's supporting us, then you are supporting Run Hard, Mom Hard too. And yeah, so yeah. It all means a lot. Go check them out and it'll help you for sure to run hard, mom hard.
All right. Well, here's our conversation with Jonna.
Hi, Jonna. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Yeah, we're so excited. So excited to hear everything. Do you want to start by sharing a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you do, what your life looks like?
Sure. So I guess we'll just start from like maybe from where I am right now. And then I think we can back up from there because I don't know. There's really no beginning. There's no real place to start my story. But so right now I am I'm a mother and I have two little kids who are almost 7 and almost 9. And I'm also a runner. So I primarily am a trail runner focusing on the ultra distances and I'm based in Southwest Wisconsin. So I'm about 45 minutes west of Madison. Okay. And, geologically this area, we're on this edge of where, Wisconsin is flat and then it kind of like, sweeps up into this more varied terrain. So I'm in the Driftless region, which is like the unglaciated terrain of, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and a little part of Iowa as well as unglaciated. But in a typical year, I train and race nationally as well. There hasn't been much traveling with our current situation. But I typically get out east and out west for racing. And then I also race regionally here too. I'm also part of my family's farm. We are organic seed producers. We grow potatoes for other farmers and home gardeners. And we also, up until 2018, we had a fairly large CSA program as well, but we retired that so that we could focus more on other areas of life because CSA is just like super all encompassing. And for those of you who don't know, CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture, which is a business model that puts the farmer in a direct relationship with the consumer. And so typically a CSA is a vegetable production. So we were delivering a box of what we harvested each week to our members. But CSAs can also be cheese and meat and eggs and a lot of different creative ways that producers are distributing their products. But we were a big vegetable farm for 24 years, and I was involved in the CSA for 11 of those years. But now we've simplified things, and we're just focusing really hard on potatoes right now. And we also have hogs that we raise for our family and for some neighbors that we grow for. We've had chickens in the past. We've had beef steers. So we're just really embedded in our food sourcing. And that feels like a main focus of our daily life is, you know, really understanding where our food is coming from, whether we're growing it or we're buying it from our neighbors.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know how much work it takes to run a farm.
Oh, yeah. Most, the notion that we get about growing food comes from these kind of like romanticized ideals, which are great. I mean, growing food is really magical and fun, but once you're scaling it up to a point where you can make a living off of it, it's just a really different experience. And I think the idea that most people get is what comes from like the homesteading model, which is like you've got a garden, you've got some hens, you have a little orchard, and you can bring your kids along, and it's all fun and games. And that is great, but it's not something that a family could support themselves off of. But I think the best way for people to really connect with the amount of work that goes into producing food is to put in a garden. Like that is one of the most like powerful things that someone can do to get close to their food. And it's so much work, but it's so rewarding. So mm-hmm. I'm not for saying sure. that homesteading isn't great. It's just, it's not like a big, enterprise that's going to be supporting multiple families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Your farm is very different.
Yeah.
And that's so cool. I love that you are kind of part of this movement of kind of shifting people's perspective from actually being in touch with where their food comes from. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you guys are doing great, great work. I'm curious, did you always want to be a farmer, or how did you become one?
Yeah. So growing up, my mother always had a big garden, and my dad's a hunter. And, so there was a degree of understanding, how food was produced, I did not plan on being a farmer. I actually went to school in New York, and I traveled around quite a bit, in between high school and through college. I studied abroad, but I met my boyfriend, who's now my husband, at a bar when I was had just turned 22. And he was, that was his first summer of like starting his career as a farmer. And so he grew up, on this family farm, and he had worked, you know, alongside his parents, and he graduated from college and decided he was going to be a career farmer. And that was the summer that I met him. And so I went out. I'd like go out to the farm, and I thought it was like really quaint, and it was like going to be really cute. And I was wearing cowboy boots, and I thought like, oh, you know, I'm really smart. Like I'm intellectual. So this is going to be like adorable for me to witness this. But it was so intense. I went out and I said I wanted to work alongside the crew, and they put me in with a crew of about 15 people, and I was harvesting kohlrabi, which is it's a brassica, so it's like a bulb that tastes like a broccoli stem, mm-hmm. but I had no idea what a kohlrabi was. And I was in that job for like 2.5 hours. Like I've never done any like level of gardening for that period of time. So it was really exhausting, but really fun. And so that was my first experience of this scale of what his family was doing. And so throughout that summer, our relationship developed, and I ended up going back to New York to finish my next semester. And throughout that half of a year, we pretty much decided like one of us needs to move. And so Jesse was looking at what he could do in New York. Like he was thinking like, I could be a firefighter. And he was playing rugby at the time. Was going to try to like join this like semi-pro rugby league. But then ultimately we decided that it just made more sense for me to come back to Wisconsin because I had family here, and he was already like pretty, integrated into the farm at that point. So I moved back that winter, and, I got a job working in a human resources department at a company here in Madison. And that was pretty unhappy time. Like I was sitting at a desk in a cubicle, and I had no idea what the weather was like. And it was really a wake up for me that I did want to work outside, and I wanted to. And so the more I saw Jesse being involved with the farm, the more that seemed appealing to me. But that was also the time when I started running, was when I had that office job.
Oh,
because okay. I felt really needed to be doing something physical.
Yeah. Does he have any brothers or sisters that work on the farm?
He does. So he has a younger brother who is no longer involved in the farm, but his brother was very involved in the CSA. And then he has a younger sister who for several years she was the farm cook. So it was really great. So we had a big farm crew, and there was all of this amazing produce, but no, like, for a long time, the family was just eating like grilled cheeses or frozen pizzas at lunch. And they're like, we have all of this produce. Like, why aren't we eating it? And the reason was because they didn't have anyone to like, to cook it for them during the middle of the workday.
Yeah.
So, Jesse's sister came on and was just creating these like amazing lunches, and we would all sit down and like feast on the vegetables that were being produced.
That's so awesome. Cool. And it's like such a community feeling then. It's like bringing everybody together over this food that everybody's helping to grow.
For sure. Yeah. It was amazing. And we have this big kitchen that's in the barn. And so everyone would just converge on this, like on a big old farm table in the kitchen, just eating exactly what's in season, and using the meat that we produce, and using other, you know, cheeses and grains from other producers in the area. So it just felt so full circle.
Yeah. Wow.
How did you get out of your HR job? Did you just say you had enough and start?
My mother-in-law had been managing all of the communications and marketing for the CSA, and she was really burning out of just doing everything. And so they brought me on as kind of like a systems communication person. And so it was just like a better job situation. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
So they just offered me a position and I just kind of moved on.
Yeah. That's so nice. And it's nice because then you were outside and you were helping, you know, build up the family business too.
Yeah. And because a lot of my work initially at the farm was focused, it wasn't like a really big shift from what I was already doing. Like I was working outdoors some of the time, but I was also very focused on creating my own systems at the farm independently. Yeah. And then my work outdoors with the crew, evolved from there. So it wasn't a super intense process of like taking this office girl and like moving, like just throwing me in the field. Like I kind of got into it. A lot of people don't want to do that.
Yeah. That's awesome. And so what is it like living so in tune with the seasons? You kind of mentioned eating seasonally, of course, because you're eating what you're growing. But just kind of what is that like? I think that's one of the things people, at least I romanticize about farm life, of being in tune with what's happening outside.
Yeah. So for me to think back to what it would be like to live outside of the shifting seasons, like brings me a lot of like stress, like to think that there would just be this static, every day is pretty much the same, like it just doesn't land right with me. And so there are years that are really intense. Like spring is a really intense time for us, because we're shipping out a lot of our potato seed, and my husband is gone for like really long days and I'm kind of on my own. But then we get these breaks where things aren't as busy and the farm kind of slows down, and that, you know, is really excellent for running. So I can kind of like undulate with the seasonality of the farm. And then that also balances really well with racing. And so there's these different times where it just makes sense for me to hunker down on work. And there's times to hunker down on training and racing. And what I love about having the seasons dictate what I eat is that, I can really, like, it helps me look forward to things more. Like, I love tomatoes, but it wouldn't feel right if I was eating tomatoes all year. Like, I wouldn't really love them as much. And so having food have seasonality, I think it is important nutritionally, but it's also just important to appreciate your food even deep and on a deeper level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I get where you're coming from with with the seasons and then your husband working. My family has a farm, or my husband's family has a farm that they grow corn and soybeans, typical Corn Belt area. And my husband works a lot. But I think all the hard work that you're putting into your work also helps with your training, because it's not just, I mean, you're on your feet and you're constantly moving and you're probably thinking about something, and all of that like mental strength goes into training too.
Yep.
And so it all, even though you may not be running as more, it probably does still help in training.
For sure. Yeah. And so when I know that I told you that I started running when I was working that office job. But I, at that time I was just running, I was doing road running, and I didn't, mm-hmm. I wasn't good at it, and I didn't really like it. Like, it just something I should do because like adults exercise, and it was like exercise part of my life. But it wasn't until, my son was born, my first child was born, that I started running trails. And at that time I had also been working on the farm for a couple of years, and it was like a whole new experience for me. And I think that coming off of the intensity of pregnancy and childbirth and like those really early days of having a newborn, where life just feels like it's kind of like hanging in the balance.
Mm-hmm.
And then going into, I really needed some time alone. So like, that's how I started spending more and more time on mm-hmm. the trails. It just felt a lot, it felt easier. And back to what you were saying about like running feeling easier coming off of those intense periods of work, it's totally true. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why, you know, when you hear people who are like, in really intense places with their education or with their job, and like running seems to click even more, that's because I feel like it's because you're doing something really hard in one area of your life, and then running feels like the easy thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like your escape from the challenge. And so I think that the rigor of the farm life really lends itself to dedicating yourself to the discipline of running.
Yeah. I love the way you put that. Yeah, way better than I did.
Well said. Yeah. Well, it's just kind of, I wonder if they're all of your jobs, motherhood, farming, running, they're all really physical. So I feel like, I mean, yes, you talk about running being an escape. But I mean, it's just, did that take a while to like build up your strength, or are you just like really strong? I mean, I feel like, I know it's like a mental escape. You can kind of quiet yourself and your mind probably from, I don't know, farm to-do lists and just like the craziness of motherhood. But I mean, do you ever feel drained, or I don't know, what's it like physically?
Yeah, so it's definitely been, it's evolved, and I've had some periods of burnout also. But when I first started, when I first got really serious about trail running, I was nursing my first baby, and then I nursed him through my, like, I got pregnant with my second child while I was still nursing him. So my theory, and I'm not a doctor, I don't even play one on TV. when a woman is nursing a baby, we have a lot of oxytocin in our system. So that's the hormone that helps us bond with our child. And it's the hormone that helps us like fall asleep really fast after we've been woken up in the middle of the night. And so when I was, in the really early stages of motherhood, I was super energized. I was super inspired. I just had like, I was so like invigorated by motherhood and by what I was able to accomplish. And running felt really pretty effortless. And and it was, I just couldn't, nothing felt hard. Like racing didn't feel that hard. The training that I was putting on myself didn't feel like it was, like I was overdoing it. And at that time I wasn't coached, like I was just self-coaching. But, and so my theory is that, so what oxytocin does is it soothes our central nervous system. So I was putting all of the stress on my body, and I wasn't sleeping very much, but I was so regulated in my parasympathetic that I could recover more quickly and I could pivot more quickly. But so I was still nursing Misha when I did my first 50 mile. And it was just at the tail end of when, no, I'm sorry. That was my second. I won my first 50 mile race when I was just finishing up nursing.
Oh my gosh.
That is so cool.
Yeah. It was really cool. And you can imagine how that felt, like, oh, the sky's the limit. I can do anything. Like, there's really nothing I can't do. But once I stopped nursing, I started like not recovering as well. And my sleep started getting dysregulated, and that later that summer I got, I thought I had some like iron issues, but what it was, Epstein-Barr virus. So my immune system tanked and I got it's mono. So like I didn't have like the typical, teenager, like sore throat type of symptoms. It was like this really deep fatigue, like disorienting, like, couldn't really get out of bed. But I couldn't go on bed rest. Like I really also didn't, I had my life set up in this way that I couldn't really just like step back and recover from this virus. And so, I went through like a year and a half of like, feeling better. And then I would race and then I would kind of like crash and go back into this like fatigue pattern. And at one point, I had this diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome, which is really not, it's just kind of like a blanket, like, we don't really know what's wrong with you. Like, you appear to be healthy, but you say you're really tired. So, yeah.
A doctor told you that?
Yeah. Okay. So my, like, after reflecting and reading, like, I really believe that the, like, nursing my kids was what was, like, really bringing all of my stress into balance. And I'm not saying that we should like nurse forever just so we can run more, but I think, but like, that's what gave me a leg up in trail and ultra distance running, was starting where I did. But I ended up getting a coach, and I work with an amazing coach, and he's helped me understand recovery and like pacing and just things that I wasn't really doing, in the early days. And so I just have like a much deeper understanding of like nutrition and hormone balance. And, but I really felt unstoppable in the first 2 years of running. And I think it's because mentally I was coming off of the really, the intense, achievements of giving birth and having little kids. But that, so it had, to answer your question, it hasn't been smooth sailing.
Totally.
I like gain a lot of wisdom and, learn how to like dial it back sometimes. And so there will be periods of time where I know that I can like dedicate a lot more time to sleep, and times where I know that I'm not going to be able to spend as much time recovering and taking care of myself. And so that will really dictate how much, like what my training load is like, and what my race schedule will be.
Okay. What are examples of like low sleep periods? When the farm is really busy, or?
Yeah. So like our last year of CSA, my husband had to leave the house at 6:30 and I had to be to work at 8, I did all of my training before work. And that was just a choice that I made so that I could spend more time with the kids in the, like in the evenings. And so I was like setting 4 a.m. alarms. And I would say I was like, and I was in peak training, like I was running like 80 mile weeks for you know, several weeks there. And that wasn't really a good idea, but it feels okay for a while. Like, it's like, it feels got it. And then, you know, and then after my race, I kind of, that was an example of like going for like, you know, 6 hours of sleep for 2 months while doing high volume training, which I don't recommend. And, but now I don't really set super early alarms anymore. I would rather not get as much training and opt for sleep, because I feel like sleep is like it's like a free drug. Like, it's like it's like something that's available to almost everyone, and it, doesn't cost anything. And it's, there's really no downside to it other than you don't have as much time to do things during the day, but so yeah, I try to get at least 8 hours of sleep. And if I don't, then I will just adjust accordingly.
Yeah. Does your coach help with those transition periods? I'm assuming you kind of talk with him on a regular basis where you're analyzing everything, your sleep and your training, your workload on the farm, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so he's really great. We check in every day through a web-based log. And if I'm starting, and he's like well aware of like my immune system issues that I've had in the past. And he's like, he's definitely likes me to be undertrained rather than overtrained. Mm-hmm. And he really trusts me to know, like, if my heart rate is starting to like creep up on easy runs, like that's time to add another rest day in, or make sure I'm getting like extra food, and even just like lowering my overall volume for the week. So it's really good to, the great thing about working with a coach is, even if you're super honest with yourself, if you're not like writing these thoughts and observations down each day, they kind of get lost. Mm-hmm. And even if you're not feeling great on your run, like by the time you get home, you might feel like that was a great run. But really, if you're not having an opportunity to reflect on it and tell someone else like how it went, a lot of those like thoughts can get glossed over. So it's been really good for me to just be super honest with myself and have some accountability, because I would run way more than I should if I didn't have him like reining me in. And I think a lot of runners are the same. You know, I think runners either need to be like encouraged to run a little more or like run less. And I'm definitely on the less end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And who is your coach, real quick?
Roach.
Okay. Nice.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, such an awesome voice in the trail and ultra world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Very much so.
And so how, like these days, what does your training look like? Like how do you, are you still doing early mornings, or when do you run these days?
I have a really, I'm almost like embarrassed of how nice my schedule is, but I have like shaped my life around making it what I want it to be. It wasn't like I just snapped my fingers and had this amazing schedule. But so I start my day, I get up before everyone else. Okay, so I'll just start by saying my husband doesn't need to be on the farm super early this time of year. So I get up and I make coffee and I do some meditation and some journaling. And I like sit down with my schedule and like figure out what I'm going to do for the day. And then I eat breakfast. Like, I haven't had breakfast yet. So I eat breakfast in the middle of the morning. I'm into like, I'm not a huge advocate of like intense fasting, like especially for women, but I do like to give myself at least 12 hours like of a rest overnight.
Okay.
So after we get off this call, I will have breakfast and I eat like a really big bowl of oatmeal with like a quarter stick of butter. Like, I eat a really big breakfast with cool. honey.
Yum.
The honey's, yeah. So the honey's from my farm. So I like super local raw honey, which I think is important for, if you're going to eat honey, it's important that it comes from like the region where you live, mm-hmm. because it's really good for, managing like allergic to allergies and so oatmeal with butter that's also local with honey, and then I'll let that digest a little bit, and then I run. So I run around 10 or 11 in the morning after a big breakfast. And then after my run, I'll eat lunch, which is like not too huge of a lunch. And then, I will eat a really big dinner kind of late in the day. And that helps me sleep well. But my training right now is not super high volume. Like my long runs are 16, 17 miles, and then I'll follow, and then I'll do like a 10. So I'll do like a 17, 10. And I'm doing more speed now. I have a race at the end of the month that, it's up in, it's the Berkey Half Marathon. So it's up in Campbell, Wisconsin. Okay. It's the USATF Trail National Championship Half Marathon.
Ooh, exciting.
Yeah, so I'm excited. I had a little hamstring issue that I was working through for August, and I, you know, most races were like getting canceled, and I was like, whatever, I'm just gonna try to heal this up. So I'm not feeling like awesome about it. Like I felt better and faster before, but I'm still like, I just want to race. Like I haven't raced. Yes. It's been almost a year since I've raced.
Yeah, just enjoy it. Like enjoy that camaraderie and like the atmosphere.
Yeah. Where in Wisconsin is it, did you say?
I didn't catch it.
So it's Cable, Wisconsin, which is where the Great American Birkebeiner is. The ski race. And so this is they do a trail race series. They have 100K, I think they might have a 50K, and then they have a marathon, and then the half marathon is the national championship. August wasn't a huge running month for me, unfortunately, but it wasn't bad. You know, I wasn't like totally not able to run, but I was trying to do more speed, and I was also doing a lot of I was doing this virtual challenge for the Leadville race series where I was trying to run like 100,000 feet. Yeah. And I got pretty close, but I was also trying to do speed at the same time to get ready for this other race that was canceled, the Ice Age Trail 50K that ended up canceled. So, but that's been the kind of a nice thing about, if there is any nice thing about COVID, is if something doesn't go right, like, the pressure isn't really there. Like there's been more grace to like, just be like, okay, well now I'm healing and now I'm resting. And even like, as I come up to this race at the end of the month, I don't really feel like totally wigged out about it. Like I'm just more, I just feel more laid back in general. So maybe
I like that perspective. And because it is just, I mean, the year has just been so weird and for everybody. So it's kind of like, well, you just see what you can do on the day when you show up, and it's amazing that you even have a race to show up at. And
yeah, I feel like it's been a really good exercise in not getting attached to things. And running does take a degree of attachment because we have to work so far ahead on it. And you know, building up to our goals. And, if a race doesn't go well, or if, you know, you get hurt in a race and you need to drop out, it can be devastating. But I've had, you know, races get canceled or trips get canceled that I was supposed to take. And it's not as much of like a gut punch. It's kind of like, okay, well, I just trust that something else is going to pop up here. And just like, there's a lot more like emotional flexibility that I've learned, through COVID, of just being able to roll with it more. And it's also been good to just live in my training and in my fitness. And like, that's kind of the whole meaning of running, is just being present in my training and not necessarily having this like destination of a race that it's building to. But, it's been really interesting in that way.
Yeah. And then, so, you are sponsored, right?
Yep. So I run for the mountain running team.
Yeah, which is so cool. And we can talk about a little bit more about that. But I'm assuming that they're not pressuring you to do races because nothing's happening. Or what are kind of their thoughts as far as racing right now?
Yeah, so so La Sportiva sponsors several races, and they're like flagship races, the Leadville 100, and which was, you know, obviously canceled pretty early on. Mm-hmm. And the Leadville virtual challenge that was, you know, that was a La Sportiva was involved with that. But they're, you know, they're just leaving it up to athletes to decide what is appropriate for them and what makes sense for each athlete in terms of traveling. And a lot of my teammates have been doing like really amazing FKTs, mm-hmm. Which has been so cool to watch. And so me living in the Midwest, like a lot of my bigger races are out of state, which there are races happening, you know, like out west, but we have, just with the kids and with our pigs, we just haven't been able to get away really. But yeah, they're just like leaving it up to athletes and just being as supportive as they can, in creating, you know, our own structure. And it's just, I think it's hard for brands to like really look ahead because, you know, you plan things and then they just get canceled. And so they've just been trying to be nimble and like pivot and, to just like support athletes in whatever feels interesting, and accessible for each.
For sure.
And I do, I have a mountain challenge that I'm doing on my own, an FKT attempt later that was supposed to happen in October, but it's getting pushed to December. It's in Hawaii. So
okay. Fun.
I was supposed to be traveling there in October for a media project, but we're pushing it out to December just because there's like a 14-day mandatory quarantine, which would mean like we land and then we have to like be in a hotel or a house for 2 weeks, which is just a long time to be gone. So I'm pushing that challenge out to December, but it's fun to have those challenges like kind of hovering in the background and like making me feel energized. But again, I just have to, I can't hold on to them too tight because we never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sounds super exciting though.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, obviously this year is weird, but normally you do travel a lot and race a lot. And so when do you go though? Okay, I know you had the CSA until 2018, I think you said. And so then you guys have been doing potatoes. Have you had pigs? Just when can you get bursts to leave the farm? That sounds really hard. And then that's one of the things that I think about with farms. Sorry, I'm rambling. But it's just like I've always wanted kind of like a hobby farm and to live more self-sustainably, but it's kind of that challenge of like, well, then you can't travel as much. And so do you do?
So we had pigs for 4 years when we were in CSA production and we never had a breeding program. Like we didn't winter over animals. We would just buy feeders from a neighbor and then which matched up really nicely with the vegetable season. It would be like mid spring to late summer and then they would be gone. But so when COVID, like when we realized like we're not going anywhere for the foreseeable future, let's get some pigs on pasture again. That was mid spring and we just knew that we were going to be like spending a lot more time in Wisconsin and we're, you know, investing more energy in a couple other revenues here. So when we were still in CSA production, I did my biggest races in the winter. So I did and spring. So like winter and spring. So I would do like I did the Sean O'Brien races, which are out in Southern California in the Santa Monica Mountains. I think like 4 years in a row. And then I also did the Gorge Waterfalls 100K, which is mid-spring. So while in when vegetables were our primary focus, late winter and early spring was my key time to travel. And some of those trips were done through road trips. Sometimes I would go by myself. And then I would do some regional races like in, at the end of the summer. Like I would do like the North Face Wisconsin. I did the Ice Age 50, which is in the late spring, early summer. But I just had to stay closer to home. My first trip away from Wisconsin during like the peak of vegetable season was when I was invited by a friend of mine to go to the Leadville training camp that's at the end of June. And she's a really good friend of mine. Her name is Randy. Randy Army. And she runs for Goo, and she invited me to come with her on behalf of Goo to go to this, you know, super high altitude training camp. So that was my first time being like in the mountains in the summer, and it felt so out of place. It was like really exhilarating. So the following summer, that was our last year of CSA. So in 2018, I went off on my own, and we knew we weren't going to be continuing on with CSA. And I was kind of like phasing out of my work, my management there. And I went to the Leadville training camp again. And that time it was with Sportiva because I was on the team at that point. Okay. And I also went to upstate New York for the 50 Mile Trail National Championship I did that in June, or no, maybe it was early July. And then this past summer, I was out west for most of the summer. Like I went to Western States, not to race, but I was there like doing some work for a brand that I worked with, Sunto. And then I was out in Oregon for another project. And then I was at Leadville. So I just spent last summer was the first summer where I was able to really be away for periods of time. And potatoes are not very intensive during the summer. So Jesse manages that, like all the irrigation and cultivating. But it's really more of a maintenance type of situation. Yep. It's not like, which I'm not as involved with, but in terms of seasonality, if you were interested in like being more self-sufficient, I think that so a great way to start is having hens. Like having some chickens is really great, and it brings you into like this daily ritual of food. But there it's really easy to get a babysitter for them. Like they're not like pigs where you're having to dump like huge 50 pound like buckets of food. Like if you had a neighbor that could just pop in every day or every other day and take their eggs and give them some food, it's easier to get away. But it's a good way to like ease into food production. And then gardens. So if you're in Idaho, like you probably have like a similar growing season to us, it's just a little shorter. But there are periods of time where you can kind of walk away and, you know, things will get a little overgrown and weedy, but it doesn't, you know, you can come back to it. But I think that if you're, for someone who's in like a bigger, more intensive vegetable production, winter is awesome for racing. It just gets expensive because you have to go, you know, get to the warmer places where you can get higher up in the mountains. You know, coastal mountains don't have the same weather patterns as high alpine, but it's possible. It just takes a lot of, you have to really want to do it because it's a big.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And, oh, sorry.
It's okay. I was just going to say, I have wanted, so we've been on our farm for 5 years now, and I have told Aaron, my husband, every single spring that I want to get chickens, and he will not let me get any.
Why?
Hates birds. Hates them. He's like, we are never getting chickens. And I'm like, I just want some. We go through so many eggs. I mean, we get them from where my father-in-law, he works at a feed mill, and one of his employees has chickens, and so he brings him eggs. So we get them from him, but yeah.
Still.
So I want my own.
Chickens and pigs are amazing for turning your green waste into, like, food. It's just, it's miraculous. Like, any, yeah. You know, all of your food scraps can just be, like, regenerated right back into another food that you can eat. And chickens are weird. I mean, they're like, you really look at a chicken, it is like a weird lizard that, like,
yeah.
A dinosaur. Oh, we had like 180 chickens that we were raising from their meat. And that was like a really intense experience because a couple of them cannibalized each other. I mean, they were like, chickens are, they're kind of intense, birds of prey in a way. I mean, they're not raptors, but they're not vegan. They want to eat like grubs and bugs. And if you like throw a mouse into your chickens, they will like fight over it and like rip it apart. I get what Aaron's saying about, not wanting to, you know, they're kind of weird, but you can just take care of them yourself. Like, he doesn't need to help.
I told him that, and he, no. And then, so Joanna, our older daughter, was like trying to get him in the barn because they have a little door that they can come out of that they can like roost in there. But it was pretty funny. He's like, enough with the chickens this spring. Like, I just want chickens. And then he just told me that he wanted to get some pigs. To like 3 or 4 pigs for us to butcher to eat. But I said, if you get pigs, I am getting chickens because I'm not a big pig fan. No. I like calves and cows and chickens.
Yeah. I've heard someone say that hens are like a gateway animal to like, and you'll have like goats and you'll have like sheep and pigs. Pigs are, I mean, they're a pretty like small time commitment for the amount of nutrition and like meat that you can put up. Yeah. If you're really using the whole animal, like it's a really good, bang for your buck in terms of the amount of time that you're putting, that you're investing.
Yeah. My father-in-law, gets them most summers and then we'll butcher and we'll put them in our freezer. So
yeah.
That's so cool. I'm wondering, I've read a couple of your articles, which we'll link, in our show notes, but, I'm wondering, I've read you talk about, just kind of dealing with death on a farm and you write it in such like a respectful way. Like, what's your journey been like with, death on a farm with animals and meat and all of that?
Yeah. So, you know, when I growing up, my dad was a hunter and he would bring, and I would go out with him too. Like when he would do like pheasant and duck hunting, I would be out with him. And so I've seen animals die from a young age, and he would hang his deer up in the garage, before they were butchered. So it has never been like a really scary or jarring, experience, but there has been like reverence and respect with it, with, you know, the animals that we eat. But on the farm, a lot of stuff dies. Like, even if you're not raising things to be, harvested for their meat, like there's rodents that need to be either moved or trapped or killed. There's birds that nest in fields that get, they're, you know, run over by implements. So it's really sad and you have to just keep moving forward. But I think a big misconception about our food system is that, like, if you're eating a fruit or vegetable or grain, like, you are exempt from this cycle of life, which is not true at all. And the larger the scale of the food production, the more animals are displaced. So, you know, we see like, you know, thousands and thousands of miles of corn, you know, if you drive through Iowa, like that used to be wildlife habitat And nothing can live there anymore. Like, it's a dead zone. Like, you can't, there's not going to be nesting birds unless there's, you know, like a hedgerow or an area for wildlife to nest. Or if you look at California, that, you know, that was all used to be wildlife habitat for, you know, for different birds and other animals. And so the more diverse a farm is, the more wildlife it can support. And even still, there's going to be, animals that attempt to live in a, you know, on your farm, and it's not going to be necessarily work out for them. But to intentionally put an animal on a farm, it's such a cyclical, intention in that. So we are regenerating the soil through the, you know, the animals on the land. And in terms of them their lives needing to come to an end, you know, a farm doesn't really have the luxury of maintaining like a petting zoo. So right. It's, you know, all of these animals that we're familiar with, you know, the pigs and the cows, like, and the chickens, those breeds have evolved alongside humans over time and have been domesticated. So, you know, if we removed those animals from farms, we would really be saying goodbye to those species as a whole. So coming to terms with the fact that I'm having relationships with these animals and loving them and caring for them and ultimately will eat them or sell them for their meat, it does, you know, it's heavy for me, but I think that when it becomes something that I don't think about, like, that's when it feels like there's a problem. Mm-hmm. And there should be emotion involved with producing animals. And, you know, all emotion is stripped away from our confinement operations. And that's where the problem is, in my opinion.
Yeah. And then, I mean, just, you can just go to the frozen section and put something in your cart and not think about it at all. And it is.
Yeah. And another layer that I feel that people who raise their own animals is, you really want to use, like, you see the value of what you're putting into that animal through the feed that you're buying or that you're growing, or, you know, depending on what kind of animal it is, if it's a ruminant or a pig, like, you know, a pig, you have to give it some feed. But, so much of the meat we eat, we're just eating muscle. Like, when you go to the grocery store, like, I know a couple people that will, like, buy liver or buy, you know, organ meats. But for the most part, people are, you know, are just eating the muscle of the animal, and that's so, leaving so much on the table. Mm-hmm. When I, you know, when we have a roast, I will, you know, I'll boil the bones and make stock and just, like, really get all the nutrition out of these animals that died for us. And it's almost like out of respect for them. Mm-hmm. And it really, I think it brings, the closer you can get to your animals, or your vegetables or your grain, the more you're going to feel driven to respect that food by using as much of it as you can. And not just extracting the muscle or extracting these few things that are, you know, that are provided for us in a grocery store setting.
Yeah. Yeah. You, feel more compelled to use everything because you put so much time and energy and money too towards it, because it costs a lot of money to feed animals. And so you want to get everything out that you can. I was going to ask you, so we have a local butcher do our cows and pigs. And they give us the organ meat, and we give it to our dogs a lot, like the liver and stuff. What type of meals have you made with your family, or do you make meals with your family with organ meat? Cause I don't know any. We, like I said, we give it to our dogs and they love it, and it's good food for them that, you know, but maybe we don't have to talk about this either, but I don't know meals that have organ meat. Cause I mean, we'll make liver and onions, but I didn't grow up eating that.
Yeah. I'd like to say that I love organ meat. Like that would be the cool thing to say, but so I know it's like one of the most valuable things you can eat from an animal, nutritionally. But I've had to kind of, choke it down like medicinally. Like, you know, if you're really like motivated, you can like drink a crazy like tea that has like the grossest thing in it. Cause you know, it's good for you. That's how I feel. Like I will cook, you know, liver or heart, but it doesn't really go down that easily for me. So what I do with organ meat is I will like cook it down for 48 hours in a crock pot so that I'm, and then use the stock. So you're pulling all of the nutrition out of the organ through boiling it. And I will usually have bones in there too. And the bones are like disintegrating. They're like falling apart because I put it on my porch. So like I'll put, organ meat and bones like in water on my porch for like, for 2 days. Cause it smells, you know, it's like, it'll fill your whole house with, you know, with those. Yeah. And then the broth is just so good to drink plain or to cook with.
Yeah.
And I was at a farm in Minnesota this past week for a media project, and we were talking about liver, and I was saying how I have to like I have this like gag reflex when I try to eat liver. I can do it, but it's like, I feel like for how good it is for me, my body should be like, yes, please eat this. But that doesn't happen. And it makes me feel like there's something wrong with me. And he was like, what you need is Braunschweiger. So Braunschweiger is a sausage that, what's like a pate type of a, you know, it's encased in like a intestine sausage, like any other sausages. And so he gave us some of his Braunschweiger and it was so good. My daughter like couldn't stop eating it. And so we're going to make some, like we have a lot of livers in the freezer. So my husband is going to make some Braunschweiger, which is, you know, it's a German style liver sausage. So I will send you a recipe. We're going to find like, I'll send you a good recipe. Typically it's made with beef livers, but I think you could make it with pork liver and there's rules, you know, you could put chicken, you know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yep.
And so I think that might be the answer for me so that I'm not like, I mean, I will still like make a stock of these bones and organs, but I think it might be a more direct way for me to be like really eating it. And it's so good. Like it's something that I want to like keep eating.
Yeah. I love bone broth though.
Mm-hmm.
We make our own stock cause it just is, it's so easy. You just put it all in the crock pot and
it's so easy. And then you know, like, and then you know, you understand, like, where your chicken or your animal came from, and it's such an important, like, you're missing so much nutrition if you just throw your bones away.
Yeah.
Like, you're just missing a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I think we've talked to other athletes, too, that use it, I mean, maybe, like, in like, long endurance races or runs, like, do you do that? With bone broth or stock or anything?
Oh, yeah.
So I have. So I have raced with, most of my caloric intake in my life in general comes from potatoes. And it's not just because we grow them. Like they actually, I believe that potatoes are like this magical complete food that has like all of these minerals that we try to get from through like these sports drinks and like, you know, have magnesium and potassium and sodium and it's highly digestible. So I have used potatoes, like very finely mashed potatoes with butter and chicken stock. And I have used that in racing and it's amazing. It's a little messy, but like, you know, people use like, you know, I'll put it in a baggie and like kind of suck out of the tip of the baggie. Not that I still like running in energy foods, but I think that, I think that that my body runs really well on potatoes.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious about that. Just like with eating so sustainably and stuff. I just was wondering about what you use for fuel with running. And so, yeah, the potatoes with the stock, that's yep. really cool. Anything else? Like, do you use, manufactured gels and things like that, or?
Oh, for a couple of years I ran for Honey Stinger, and I used, like, I ate a lot of the waffles and gels, and, I still love Honey Stinger. I just kind of got to a point where I couldn't, like, something switched. And I don't know if it was like an internalized memory of feeling sick while eating those things, but I just, like, at Leadville last summer, I was like, this doesn't work. Like, I cannot. Don't make me. And so now I use Spring Energy, which mm-hmm. has more whole foods in it. I still believe that honey is a very powerful, fuel, but I haven't like bottled up any of my own honey and brought it out, but I've thought about that.
That'd be good.
Yeah. So in longer, like in races or in longer runs, I'll use Spring Energy, and I usually head out on a training run, like, you know, very well fueled. But for multiple hours, I would use Spring and, potatoes. And then in a race setting, you know, I'm very, you know, I'm a big believer in, like, not using processed foods in my daily life, but in a race, like, everything, it's like anything goes. Uh-huh. I love Mountain Dew. I love Coke. I love Skittles. potato chips, like, that are fried in the worst possible things. Uh-huh. I don't get snobbed at all during races. but day to day, like, something that I don't really celebrate in the ultra running space, which I see a lot of, is I don't really think it's, like, cute when people, like, think that junk food is awesome. Like, I think that running is a big, endurance sports in general, or just sports in general, are big, I guess luxury is the word, or, we're lucky to have the energy to do this. And so I think if we're going to be burning through energy, we should put some thought behind, like, what impact that has. And so I'm not saying that I don't eat Doritos from time to time, but I don't really like to encourage a junk food lifestyle, because mm-hmm. it's bad for the planet, it's bad for our bodies, it's bad for humans who are growing these foods that are just, like, really, there's nothing really good about it. And there's a lot of multinational companies getting super rich on addicting people to these foods that kill the planet. So I think there's a place for them, but I don't think that the bulk of our energy should come from, I just think it perpetuates the wrong cycle. So mm-hmm. if we're going to be, like, burning through more energy than we really need, I think we should put some thought into, like, where that energy is coming from and, like, what systems we're supporting. Mm-hmm. But so for most of my running, you know, I'm not running more than 2 hours at a time, for the most part. And so I don't really need a lot of, I don't really need to carry a lot with me, but, on longer runs, I do carry some foods. And then in terms of, like, recovery foods, I think there's a place for, like, bars and powders, but I think a lot of runners, like, forget how to eat food. Like, they think, like, I just did this sport. I just did, like, a triathlon workout, or I did, like, a running workout. Now the industry is telling me I need this thing to recover. Otherwise I'm not going to be recovering. But really, you could eat, like, a plate of, like, food too. Like, right. that, and your body will recognize it. So we have to remember that we are operating in, like, a capitalistic system that is, like, telling us, sending messages that are based on, like, sales. And so I do use some, like, electrolyte drinks, and, like, sometimes I'll put, like, a scoop of grass-fed collagen powder into, like, a cup of milk and slam it, like, if I've just done a really hard run. But for the most part, I think that all of those benefits can be, you know, we can just get them right from like the food that we eat. And sometimes it's not convenient, and I eat like Lara bars or whatever if I'm, you know, if I'm not around a kitchen. But I think for the most part, we should remember that we have the intuition to eat food, and our body has like a mechanism built in to tell us like what to eat. Mm-hmm. And we don't need an app to tell us what to eat, or we don't need like, a brand to tell us what we need. It's just, if we get enough food and mm-hmm. food, I'm just like, it can be like a big bowl of like soup with like a hunk of bread. That's going to be better than like a smoothie with like 17 powders and like, so, and I don't believe in like calorie tracking or, you know, macro tracking. I just think that those sciences aren't as precise as people would like us to believe they are. And a lot of that research is based on young men or people with health problems, like, you know, obese people. And so what a 37-year-old woman needs, you know, my needs are so unique. And so, listening to my body and looking at the foods that are available to me right here in my micro region is like way more powerful than like trying to use an app that was designed around research that was done 10 years ago. Like it just doesn't, it's, there's such a big lack in that.
Oh yeah. Right. For sure. No, I know. And I think that's just part of being a conscientious human. Of and remembering you have the power to know your body and what it needs. And I love that. I mean, totally believe in that too. And so I guess I'm wondering how, with our current food system in the US and like how, and being on your farm, how do you keep fighting for all this and stay positive and, you know, just how do you ever feel like down about this or do you know what I'm saying? Like, how do you focus on what we can be doing to like improve just people's health and the planet's health and all of that, the big stuff?
For sure. Yeah, I think, I mean, I spend like a lot of hours trying to like solve the world in my mind, which I, a lot of us do in our own like unique corners of how we, you know, make the world a better place. And ultimately, like I don't have a lot of personal control over what the rest of the world does, but I see a lot of injustice in our food system, and it's really scary, and it can be really easy to like spiral into like an existential like thought pattern and be like, well, what difference can I make? Like there's, I can't have any impact here. But I think what's really important to remember is that like every day we do have, like we have multiple times each day to make choices about how we're spending our money, not just on food, but like, you know, on our clothing and on our, you know, what kind of, if we want to drive our car, if we want to ride our bike. But food is like a really immediate way that is like cycles through these markets rapidly. So if you don't, you know, good food is expensive, and I don't believe there's any cheap food. Like the price tag at the store might reflect an inexpensive cost in that, like in that moment, but those costs will be paid down the line, like in our healthcare system or, you know, just in like greater public health. And so by buying cheap food, what we're actually doing is like enriching multinational companies who are making people and the planet sick. But by spending a little more either time or money, because we can, you know, we can grow our own food or, get involved with farmers who do, that's completely bypassing that entire system. And so, and we don't always have like the energy or the time or the money to do everything perfectly, but the more, you know, the more we do, the more we're influencing the markets. And mm-hmm. of course, we also have the opportunity to vote for politicians who are going to enlist change in our systems as well. And so getting political is super important. But day to day on a granular level, everything you buy has a meaning. Mm-hmm. And it just depends on where you want to put your money. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you buy some bananas that are 29 cents a pound, like that's okay. Just eat the bananas, enjoy the bananas. But if you're going to go, you know, buy some potatoes, like maybe understand who grow those potatoes and why are they so cheap? They're cheap for a reason. Mm-hmm. It's not because food is inexpensive to produce. It's because humans are being exploited in the process. Land is being exploited. And it's really just up to us to decide which systems we want to support. Mm-hmm. And the more you dig into it, the more upsetting it becomes, and it can be really easy to get down. And it's important to feel those down feelings as well, and to feel like fired up and pissed off. But there's actionable things that we can do each day, and that really comes from our spending habits and where we want to, like, you know, you hear the saying, like, vote with your dollar. Like, it really is true that we can put our money where our mouth is.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Sorry. If people are wanting to get more involved and grow their own food and be a little bit more self-supported or sustained, what are some of your tips for people to get started? And especially, like, I have 5 acres of land that I can grow stuff on, but not everybody has that. So how would you do some of that stuff in a smaller space setting too?
Yeah, and that's one of the big things about food production is, like, having land and or even having a yard is, like, it comes from a place of access, and a lot of people live in urban areas where there isn't even like access to fresh food at all. And so like in your case, you know, putting in a small garden or putting some chickens down, those are things that are pretty easy to do. If you live in a city and you have a porch, you can put in some tomatoes and herbs. And then just also supporting local farmers markets and finding farms that are in your area, and like reach out to farmers, like ask them if you can get involved, like if you can volunteer on the farm, or if there's anything that you can do to support them, or ask them what's the best way to like most directly support your farm. And oftentimes that doesn't mean buying from a grocery store, because there's always like, you know, the farmer is cut out of a lot of the value of their food in that situation. Not that there aren't great small grocery store cooperatives, but in general, having the closest connection you can to your producer is going to enrich them and allow them to have to pay their workers more, to pay their, you know, to have better practices on their farm. And so keeping the cycle of currency as small as you can will have the greatest impact, which is really important in rural communities, because rural communities are getting so hollowed out right now and so mm-hmm. extracted from. So if you don't know where your food is coming from, it's probably passing through many brokers and many hands before it reaches you. And yeah. And it's impossible. Well, it's not impossible, but it's really hard to have like a perfectly full knowledge of all of your food, but every little step counts. Like this year we started buying our flour from a local flour producer that's just a couple miles away, and up until then we had been buying flour at like Whole Foods, and it was organic, but I don't know, it's all like mixed together and comes from different mills, and we didn't really know. But it feels cool to like, I know those farmers and I know their kids, I know their belief systems, and like I'm excited to watch them grow. Mm-hmm. And so it also just feels better, and then the food tastes better, and like there's just really there's no downside to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And it just keeps, it keeps the money in that community with those people to keep doing these great things that they're doing. I'm just wondering about, I mean, cause there's great things, great tips that you shared, like that we could do. I mean, what if, you know, so maybe you have a garden. I mean, I'm thinking about my situation. Like we do usually have a garden when we're in Bend, at home, but you know, so what about when money is tight? And what, I'm wondering if you just have any, if there's any like priorities, I guess, or like maybe like the two places to start when you want to be more, involved in where your food's coming from. Like you want to join a CSA, but maybe that's really expensive. It's not in your budget or, you know, just like little things. Like what about when it just feels hard?
Yeah. Really good question. And, so at the beginning of COVID, when everything felt really terrifying, do you remember that? When like it felt scary to like even go like a mile from your house because you're like, what if the world starts on fire? Like, this feels like a crisis. I'm fine. But this is how a lot of people probably feel every day. And how can we possibly ask the world to like care about like recycling or like anything when the world feels so heavy? And so what I think when money is stressful or there's like, or life just feels, like there's not a lot of capacity to put a lot of energy into food. So I live in, so Madison, Wisconsin is like my main metro area and we have a great organization here called Fair Share CSA Coalition, which is like a coalition of CSA farms and, they have a program called the Partner Shares Program, which helps lower income families afford CSA shares. And it's funded through, through CSA, like through membership donations. So like members of our farm would donate into this fund. And there are a lot of organizations and programs like this around the country. So if you know, if you just take a little bit of time and see what's out there, there's a lot of, like grant money and crowdsourced funds for people to be able to afford produce because the market price for organic locally grown produce is really, it's really high and it's, you know, it's expensive. Also on our farm, we had a program called the partner, called the worker share program, which is where someone would come out for 4 hours a week and in exchange, they would get their box of produce. Now that does take, flexibility in someone's schedule, like not everyone has 4 hours to drive out to the country and work. But for people who do, for people who are like, you know, in college or in between work situations, that can be a really great way to use your like physical body to actually earn your produce. And that's a great way to get involved. And our farm was one of the pioneering farms of that model, and I know that it's used a lot around the country, you know, across many CSAs. So that would be another idea is like looking for a farm that is willing to barter labor for food. Small scale farmers love bartering, and I don't even know if I should say that. Like, I know it, like, accountants hate it because I don't even think it's like legal in a lot of ways. But, so if you want to, let's say you want to like, you want to get 5 chickens in the freezer from a producer that you like, ask them if you can clean out their barn. Like, you know, farmers are always down for extra help.
Oh yeah.
And then yes. If you have freezers, which having freezer space is also a luxury, like not everyone has a chest freezer or even like even a freezer beyond like a little mini fridge. But if you do have a freezer, a really economical way to have really high quality meat is to buy a whole or a half animal. So you can, you know, put up a half hog for the winter and you can get all of those great, like, you know, cuts that you wouldn't normally find in the store. So that's a really great way to connect with farmers. And then if there was a priority in terms of like what to invest your money in, I would say that animal products are the dirtiest foods there are, like, and especially the fats of animals. That's where like toxins, hormones, like antibiotics, like live in the fats of animals. So like butter, milk, cream, cheese, fatty cuts of meat like bacon. If you can invest in organic animal products, that is like one of the best things you can do for your health. And even better, if you can buy them from a small scale producer and like, you know, put an animal in the freezer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, you know, produce is really important to buy locally. It's not always available. And buying organic produce that's grown in Mexico or California, it's not the end of the world. It's not ideal. And even buying produce that is conventionally grown, you know, that's, it's going to happen. Sometimes I think it's important just to eat fresh produce, no matter where it came from, and then just kind of work up from there.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Thanks. It's helpful.
Oh, how is it, how are your kids involved in the farm and in running? Do they ever come with you?
Yeah. So, well, I'll start with the farm. So when they were really little, I had this idea that they were going to come do everything with me, and I was going to like wear them wrapped on me, this beautiful, like, hippie mom that like didn't skip a beat because I had a baby. And that kind of worked in the spring. They were both born in the winter, and in the spring they would come into the greenhouse and I would be doing seeding, and it was kind of a low stress environment. But our farm is, you know, it's really big. There's a lot of tractors. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of people, and it's not safe. And so, our kids, you know, went to daycare pretty early on, but they do, you know, they do a lot of tractor work with my husband. They ride along in the tractor. They're super involved in taking care of the pigs, and they have, you know, they don't have any like chores that are theirs at the farm, but they are kind of along for the ride, especially this year since we don't like have school and stuff.
Yeah.
But they are more involved actually at my parents' farm, and my parents have like a small poultry and hog farm, and they have like actual chores there where they collect eggs. And they know, like, you know, how to do the feeding. But that's a much smaller scale, and that's more like the pace is just, slower. But they are very, like, very steeped in like our seasonal eating, and they do a lot of foraging with me. I don't even think they realize how much they know. It's just like been part of their life from the beginning. And then, in terms of running, so when I first started doing ultra distance racing, I had to bring my babies with me because I needed to nurse them because, you know, I needed to like get my milk out.
Yeah.
But as they got older, they would want me to like hold them at aid stations, and they, you know, didn't really understand. So, there was a couple of years there where I asked my husband, like, can you not have them in aid stations? Because it's just like, it's really tiring, and it's kind of a little sad too. Mm-hmm. But now they love it, and they love like running through the finish line with me. And they love at aid stations. It's really fun for kids because there's like candy, and you know, they love like drinking all the sugary drinks. And so they've spent a lot of time like in finish areas waiting for me. And then we've taken a lot of like road trips for training and, just like family adventures. And they've spent a lot of time like kind of being up high in trails, adventuring around. So I would say they're super involved, but the thing about ultra distance running is that the time variables are so wide, you know, like a race, it's like I'll be here within this 4-hour window.
Yeah.
So, you know, as they get older, I also want to like keep in mind that that might be a little boring also. But they are, I feel like it's cool that they get to see like a grown woman like really throwing down in a sport, because we don't see that very often. Like it happens on like the pro level and the Olympic level and other sports, but the cool thing about running is, you know, everyday average people can be racing alongside the best runners in the world, and you can make the sport like as serious as you want to, and you can step away from it for periods of time. But if you want to make running your life, like you can really do that at any age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's a powerful example for kids to see moms still doing it.
Yep. Yeah.
We're here today. Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm wondering, you did talk about media projects. What do you mean by that? What do you do?
Oh, I'm a writer, and I write for different magazines and brands. And then I'm also a film producer. So I have a project that is a series, but it's on hold right now for COVID. Like we're going to pick it back up in, 2021. So that's like an adventure travel series that looks at the intersection between food and adventure. So we like pick a location and we pick an athlete who lives there, and then we explore food that's in their region.
Whoa.
Yeah. So far we filmed in Colorado and Hawaii, and we were supposed to be in Puerto Rico in March, but we are planning to be back there early 2021.
Okay.
And then I also, I do projects, for different magazines and brands. Like I have a couple projects coming up for Patagonia and, Patagonia is great. I'm working with this magazine and media platform called Modern Huntsman,
mm-hmm.
but it's also just about conservation and environmentalism.
That article that I read from.
Oh, right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Out to Wyoming in October for a story for them. And then in November, I'm going to be doing a film with two ice climbers that are on the La Sportiva team. I'm going to be ice climbing, which.
Oh my gosh.
I know. I've never ice climbed, but I'm like working on my strength, and they have like a training program they're having me do. So it's also about hunting. We're going to be elk hunting and ice climbing in Montana.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
This is so, you are doing so much.
You are.
That is so cool. I love that. How do you find, those projects? Like how do viewers find that?
So the ice climbing project will be, we're still working on our distribution platform, and one of the climbers, he has like a pretty strong media background. So we're looking at streaming for that. And then the other project, Eat Local, Run Wild, that one we're distributing through REI and Outside TV. Okay. And, but that it's very much like COVID, like really sidelined us. So I don't even know when it's going to release yet. We have to figure out like, when we can travel and what that looks like.
How did you get involved in that kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these concepts are my own, and so I created the concepts and brought the teams together and found the partnerships. So it really was born of like me wanting to do things, and then just needing to like do them on my own. So it's, you know, I do get media assignments and I'm brought into things, but for the most part, I'm pitching out. So like I am the creator pitching out. I'm always open to being brought into projects, but for the most part, I'm bringing myself in and then going from there.
That's awesome.
Well, yeah. And you're bringing them to great companies. I mean, Patagonia, REI, that's amazing.
Yeah. It's really good. And I think it all comes from this like authentic place of like wanting, like everything stems from food. Like that's really my like core. And you know, running is like a separate sport that I do, but, I really think that adventure and food sourcing and environmentalism, they're all like so intertwined. And for the most part, food is like separate and it's on the outside. And we see a lot of like environmentalism and adventure together, but I really want to like bring food. I keep wanting to like bring it back in, bring it back in, bring it back. It really, food is environmentalism. Like it really is. It all comes like everything we eat has an environmental impact. And so I'll let you know a lot of brands recognize this. And so it's a good time to be advocating for more awareness around our food choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh yeah. And I really, it really does all complement each other really nicely. And so that's really, that's good that you're bringing it back and bringing it back. That is awesome.
I'd like to see our, you know, our strongest voices in the sport being focusing on food. And, you know, like I said earlier, in the ultra running world, like there's so much energy that we put out with our bodies. And so it's just like a big opportunity to be centering the conversation about, well, like, what are you putting back in? Like, are you, you know, we have to have our performance foods, but if we're living this lifestyle where we're like pouring out so much energy, like we have even more opportunity to like put more quality, thoughtfully sourced energy back in.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it.
Well, let us know how we could help with anything, if we can help with stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. This is exciting.
Yeah, stuff. Very exciting.
Yeah. How about, we always, at the end, we always ask our guests two questions to leave off. First one is, what is your favorite race that you've ever done?
My favorite race is the, I would have to say it's the Sean O'Brien 50 mile. I really like the 50 mile distance in general. Like it's enough of a, I mean, it's a legit ultra distance event, but it's also enough to finish in like a reasonable amount of time. Mm-hmm. So, and Sean O'Brien is really cool because it, like it's a very Verdi race. Like there, I think in the 50 mile, there's 12,000 feet. But it's not altitude. So it's easy for me to drop into that event. It starts at sea level, you know, and it climbs from there, but it's, it feels approachable, but gnarly enough to like get me excited in a mountain sense. And there's water crossings and it's like a lot of ocean views and it's just a, yeah, it's just a magical race.
Yeah. Yeah. And then our second question is, what is your favorite go-to healthy meal that you eat or make with your family?
So I cook really simply. Like I don't feel like I need to overcomplicate cooking with recipe, you know, like complex recipes. So I usually start with whatever is in season. And the thing about seasonality is potatoes are always in season because they store all year until the new harvest comes in. So, we eat a lot of soup in our family. And I make a lot of blended soups because it's easier for my kids to eat like on a spoon and we dunk like big chunks of bread into soup. And, so my favorite, I have a recipe that I created that's like a based on potatoes, but I really throw whatever else is in there. Like I use carrot in it. I use winter squash depending on the time of year. Sometimes I'll even put tomatoes in it, but the base, it's based on potato and chicken stock.
Mm.
The kids don't, they're not like against vegetables, but they don't really realize how good, how healthy it is. And so, and it's also something that I make and I freeze and I can like pull out and I'll even like chug it after a run because it's full of like good, vegetables and fats and like everything that my body needs right after.
Mm-hmm. And so you sent the link to your, that recipe on the La Sportiva website. Yeah. So I'll link to that and we'll share that with everybody. It sounds so good. And it's making me excited for fall, which we happen to be experiencing, cooler mornings. I'm noticing the trees are starting to change a little bit. So let's get into that cozy season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and that recipe is also really good with any kind of, like sometimes I'll saute like greens and like put it on top, or you could even cook, like if someone's plant-based, they could put like tempeh on top, or I like to put like ground beef on top. So it's really just a vehicle for like any, you could even put like grains in it. It's just like a, it's a perfect base for like anything else that you want to build into your meal.
Yeah. It sounds so good.
Yeah.
I have really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah. It's really enlightening. I love like thinking more and being challenged to think more about our food and where it comes from, and kind of get a glimpse into the life of somebody that makes so, so many potatoes.
Yeah.
You know, it's awesome hearing your story and how you balance motherhood with training, with farming, and it's a lot. You're amazing.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
You are.
Both of you, and I think that there's just so much like wisdom that running mothers can share, and it's been so fun getting to know both of you.
Yeah. Well, thanks for adding to that.
Oh my gosh, she is so cool.
Mm-hmm. Very.
And she's doing so much. How do you even get that much done in a day?
I don't know. You know, I think, I feel like those are all really hard jobs.
Well, and they're like a lot of labor intensive, but a lot of like mentally intensive jobs as well.
Oh yeah.
And then being a mom and having two kids, like
that may be being one of the harder jobs. Yeah.
I know. It's crazy.
I was going to ask her which of her roles is most challenging, but I think I forgot, or we moved on to something else. But
yeah,
I am really just kind of inspired by her, because I don't know. It just, it makes me, I want that. I want those things. I want to be doing it all. And
yeah.
And I do love, I mean, my very limited farming experience, which is very limited, but you know, just being outside and working with your hands and it, like that physical aspect of it is I would think would be very tiring in addition to training, but it's also really satisfying, maybe.
Yeah.
Is the word, you know,
good, like your soul.
Yeah, to be in the dirt.
I feel like when I'm adding more to my plate, I get more done, but I'm like efficient at it.
True. Yes. Because, you're empowered.
Yes. And then when I'm like, oh, I'm in a lazy state, like the last 2 days, I've just sat on the couch at night and watched a movie. Probably shouldn't. I mean, the first night I was folding laundry. So I was doing something, but,
shit.
But before our vacation, I mean, I was getting 4 to 5 hours of sleep. I was waking up, I was editing, I was going to work and doing all this stuff, taking care of all the kids. Like I felt, yes, it was extremely tiring, but I got so much done and I was so efficient. And maybe how she organizes her life in such a way that she's efficient at everything she does. And clearly she does a great job at everything.
Heck yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. It's amazing. She's a great runner. I can't wait to see how she does in her race coming up. It's just great. So anyway, if all you people out there enjoyed this conversation, you can subscribe to this podcast. You can rate and review and share it with your mom tribe or your running buddies or anybody that's into food. Mm-hmm. It really applies to a wide range of people, I think. And adventurers. Yes. And then you can also subscribe to Treeline Journal's newsletter, which is found at treelinejournal.com. And we send out one email a week on latest articles and podcast episodes and, the show notes to those. So you can stay in the loop that way.
And if you want to leave us a message or tell us someone else we can talk to or a comment, you can email us at runhardmomhard@gmail.com. Or you can click the link in the show notes below. It's the Anchor link, and you can leave us a voice message, and we would absolutely love to hear from you.
Yes, we would. Definitely. And so, yes, I hope everybody's having a great day out there and keep doing your thing.
Yeah. Go run hard, mom hard.
Yes.
Sorry, my microwave keeps going off because of my coffee.
When did you put that in there? Like 1,000 years ago? I just got new headphones to edit with.
Look like a rapper baller. Yeah.
I'm a real podcast. I'm going to go DJ in the club. I love you.
Rock on. That's what I meant. Bellin will be like, A-OK.
I like your note. Make it sound unscripted. Welcome.